Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, Arizona's role in the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II.
And the subtle, or perhaps not so subtle, art of mocking the president.
But first, it is time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
They fire from a distance, but their pepper spray canisters create a choking cloud. And, you know, one of the agents on the field literally looked and fired a pellet directly at me.
Come on, you know, Arizona Independent Party, would you naturally assume that that's everyone that's registered as an independent? I mean, I would, and I like to think that I'm in the know.
In our standards, equity simply meant giving every student fair access to learning, seating a child where they can hear, providing large print, or pre-teaching vocabulary for English learners.
It's a common sense bill. It's a public safety bill. It's not excessive regulation. So I think it'll be well received, and it's been well received from the public.
Land is perhaps one of the most important areas, and we have nearly 300,000 acres within 10 miles of cities and towns that are going undeveloped, unleased, or whatever.
I just think that we've had for too long, both at the state and the federal level, people in, and we need new representation and fresh ideas and a younger generation.
And joining me to talk about a lawsuit challenging the number of signatures independent candidates need to collect to make the ballot, a renewed national effort to flip the state legislature, and more, are Doug Cole of High Ground. Doug, good morning.
Good morning, Mark.
And Democratic strategist Tony Connie. Tony, good morning to you.
Good morning.
So, Doug, let me start with you on this lawsuit. A couple of things related to state parties and elections here. I want to start with the Arizona Independent Party, which is the party formerly known as No Labels, which has sued over the signature requirements for independent candidates to make the ballot. Independent candidates have to collect a lot more signatures than a Democratic candidate or a Republican or even a Libertarian or Green Party candidate. I'm curious, we're not lawyers in this room, but like,
thank goodness.
You said it, not me. You know, like what I'm curious what you make of this. Seems like it has been an impediment for independent candidates in the past.
Well, this has been in the public dialogue for years, Mark. Because it is so unfair that independent candidates, which are the second largest group of voters in the state of Arizona, you know, it's roughly a third, a third, and a third, but Republicans being the most, and then non-affiliated voters slash independents, and then the Democrats come in the bottom of those three thirds. So you're disenfranchising, in my mind, that second largest voter group in Arizona, because it requires like six, seven times more signatures to qualify for the ballot. So this has been a dialogue that's been happening. We had Prop 140 last election cycle, mm-hmm. that the Make Elections Fair Act that the voters rejected. There's been other efforts before, it's all about voter access. Remember, each state gets to decide how they make their own state laws in on voter access and how they conduct elections. So. This is up to Arizona. It's up to the voters if they want to do it through an initiative or a referendum process or the state legislature and now a court ruling. So that's where we are with this. It's probably going to be too late for the 2026 elections to affect anything, because we're already underway collecting signatures.
Tony, in the past, we have seen the two major parties, the Democrats and Republicans, not being super thrilled about something like this, like perhaps for obvious reasons. Do you think this is something that, for example, if the court ruled that the signature requirement is too high, would that lead to more independent candidates on the ballot, do you think?
It might, but this lawsuit's about the Arizona Independent Party, isn't it?
Right. So, like, well, they're the ones who filed it. Yeah.
So right there is the confusion with the name, the Arizona Independent Party. This conversation started with us saying it's about unaffiliated independent voters, but really it's about small parties that maybe have, you know, that means that they have, you know, the way the state works, the number of registered voters is a percentage of the number of registered voters you have to get from a signature. And so You know, I want to point out that confusion, which is part of the reason why I think the name would change from No Labels to Arizona Independent Party took place. But, you know, I think that if this does go through, there probably will be more candidates who qualify for the ballot. Whether or not they actually succeed is another question. I think getting people on the ballot is one thing, but being able to appeal to voters is a second thing. And the way elections have worked for the last several years, the most important thing is the partisan branding. That's really what's making a big difference in these elections. You saw up, you know, in Andy Biggs' district where there was a sort of a moderate unaffiliated candidate, a Democratic candidate who had no support in Andy Biggs, and the Democratic candidate who had no sort of structural support or money was the one that got second place because people were voting based on partisanship. Mm. And so there's more than just access to the ballot that's at play here. That's important for sort of candidates in order to be taken seriously. And so I think more candidates qualifying, sure, but I'm not sure that'll make a big difference when it comes to elections.
Well, so Tony, you mentioned the confusion, and the Democratic Party this week filed a lawsuit to try to get the a court to require the Arizona Independent Party to change its name. I don't know if it has to go back to the No Labels Party or just make it not the Arizona Independent Party. Last week, the Clean Elections Commission sued basically over the same thing. Sounds like you think there is a legitimate claim of confusion here.
Yeah, I think that there is. Sure. I do think that there can be some real confusion with that here.
Well, we saw – we heard your setup, the Democratic Party Chair Charlene Fernandez, yeah, make her points, and then Tom – you just brought up Tom Collins and the Clean Elections Commission. They've also joined in this effort. And his point that Tom Collins, I've heard him make over the last couple of weeks, is look, if I'm not paying attention and I check on when I'm registering to vote at MVD or wherever, where I thought it was choosing – being an independent, a party not declared, that's kind of the two categories mm-hmm. we have now, an independent party. I assume then that I can pull the ballot of my choice because in Arizona, if you're not affiliated, you can choose whether to pull the Democrat ballot or a Republican ballot or a Green ballot. And all of a sudden, an independent party ballot shows up in my mailbox if I'm voting early, then really, there's no recourse at this point. So that's the point, I think, when the Clean Elections Commission was making their vote to challenge this effort. And I think it's valid.
And that really hurts independent voters because it means that an independent voter who decided that they liked a Democrat in a primary, wanted to vote in the primary, would show up and they'd be told they weren't allowed to do so.
Correct, because there's a lot of voters that in the independents that are very wise. They go back and forth depending upon what race mm-hmm. is important for them yeah. in the primary.
Or what level of competition there
Correct.
Is. Doug, do you think that the signature requirement, like would you expect that the parties might get involved to try to stop the change and keep independent candidates having to get more signatures?
Well, I think as Tony so eloquently stated, that, you know, they're protecting their brand. And I think his choice of the congressional race in Andy Biggs' district, I think, is very illustrative of what's going on. I can't imagine them not protecting their brand. I mean, that's why Prop 140 failed. There was a lot of partisan money that came into that effort to kill it.
So let's move from lawsuits to there's no great transition for this one. So we'll just go down to Southern Arizona, where a new Congresswoman Adelita Grijalva was at an ICE raid in Tucson. I think this was late last week, and she says that an ICE agent pepper sprayed her. ICE and Department of Homeland Security has denied this, saying that she's making it up. Tony, I'm curious what you make of all this. I mean, absent, I guess, eyewitness or body camera footage, we really don't know exactly what happened. And even with that, maybe we don't know exactly what happened. But Congresswoman Grijalva, you know, we heard her just say, you know, there's sort of a cloud of smoke and an agent looked right at her as they were firing.
Yeah. And there's some, you know, and there's some video footage from, you know, people who are at the event, I think, that shows what the congresswoman is claiming took place. And, you know, historically historically, meaning like the last – boy, it feels like this term has been a really long time. But
last
Trump has only
months,
been in
maybe.
Office in 11 months. But over the last 11 months, ICE has not been, you know, in their public statements very honest about the situations that they're facing. The number of times that they've claimed one thing and then when it came to a court filing or something, they had to claim something else is very, very high. And so – I would take the congresswoman at her word here because I don't know what she gains from making this up. And it is, you know, it's just it's this kind of thing where those aggressive, you know, tactics are really backfiring. And I think that the public is very frustrated with it.
Mark, I would have been surprised if Congresswoman Grijalva was not there. I mean, this is her father. This was his brand when he was the longtime serving congressman and Pima County supervisor down in southern Arizona. This is their family brand. And this type of demonstration supporting her community, it's not going to stop. That's what she's going to do. And she does it well, and that's how she's been on the school boards down in Tucson, and followed her father on the Pima County Board of Supervisors. So, you know, she's going to continue this and fight back, especially as long as Donald Trump is in the White House. But even if he wasn't in the White House, I would expect, you know, in a similar circumstance, that she would be there. That's just her brand.
Is there anything? I mean, to Tony's point, like, does she gain anything? And not to suggest that what she says happened didn't happen, but is there anything to gain from her to embellish this?
Look, everyone has their corners in the boxing ring. I mean, this situation with the Trump administration and with immigration enforcement and ICE, we're going to see this time and time again over the years remaining in the Trump administration, which are many years left.
3 years left.
Yeah. Exactly.
Tony, we saw this week the Democratic Legislative Campaign Committee, a national organization, added both the Arizona House and Senate to its list of immediate battleground flip opportunities. This has come after a number of special elections around the country where Democrats have done pretty darn well in many cases, flipping seats or at least outperforming what they did last year. I have to say, though, this is a song we've heard before, right, that this is the year that the Democrats are going to flip the Arizona legislature. I'm curious what you make of this investment, this effort by this national group here coming up in 2026.
Well, I wish it was a bigger investment. Not that it's a bad investment, but I think that it's going to cost a decent amount of money in order for us to flip one of these chambers. I think that it comes down to – I don't think it's a wrong label. I don't think that it's overly optimistic. I think that now it comes down to us here in the state as Democrats. It's about candidate recruitment. It's about how much money the candidates raise. And it's about whether or not our candidates can run, you know, robust modern campaigns. And I think in the recent past, a handful of the campaigns on the legislative side from Democrats, I think they fell short. And – you know, sort of tactically, not that the candidates did. And so that's really the question this year, which is are they going to be able to run an aggressive enough campaign to overcome, you know, some really smart Republican legislative tactic? That's been the challenge, because when you have a party switch election where the governor needs Republicans to vote for her in order to win, it gets much harder the farther you go down the ballot to convince those people who typically vote for Republicans to vote for Democrats. So you have to make the case directly to them, and, you know, that's really what it takes.
Well, Doug, I wonder, you know, this is obviously a big election for Democrats and Republicans, of course, in Arizona, but Democrats are defending three statewide seats, and it feels like that is where a lot of the oxygen would go, kind of to Tony's point, that by the time you get down the ballot, are people maybe paying as much attention, or does it become harder for Democrats to maintain that down the ballot?
Well, you're correct about the three statewide elections that are currently held by Democrats. That'd be the governor, the secretary of state, and the attorney general. But what's not on the ballot this time is U.S. Senate. You know, we've had
for the first time in a long time.
In a long time, it's because it all started with John McCain's death, and it created, you know, musical chairs. So we do not have a U.S. Senate candidate, which draws in millions and millions and millions of national of dollars. Tony's correct. Down ballot, people tend to stay with their own party once they get off the marquee races. We're in a midterm cycle. Also, we don't have Donald Trump on the ballot like we had in 2024. Democrats tried to counter that by having Prop 139, which is the abortion access in 2024. They put Democrat-aligned groups in the ADLCC and in the DLCC put in roughly $10 million in 2024, and they lost seats. Two chambers got more Republican. And historically, on midterm elections, if a party controls both the White House and both chambers of Congress, it tends to be a banner year for the opposite for the opposite party. And I think that they're trying to maybe try to ride that coattail in here. But historically in Arizona, midterm elections, because of the voter registration and alignment with the non-affiliated voters, tend to vote more Republican, no matter who's in the White House or who controls Congress. So it's going to be – I agree with Tony. It's going to be a steep hill to climb. I think they've announced $50 million, but they're going to they said they want to play in 42 states.
I would say – the one thing I'd say is that like we can't forget how wildly unpopular Trump is right now and how very closely aligned these legislative candidates are going to be on the Republican side to Trump. And that's what it comes down to is that – don't forget, like I said, it's about branding. This will be a nationalized race even though it's at the local level. And you know, the Democrats just won a district that Trump won by 12 points in Georgia. And so I do think that compared to previous years, the wind is at our backs. But still, it's going to be tough.
So do you think then that legislative Democratic candidates will be trying to make themselves the anti-Trump? Do legislative races on the Democratic side become nationalized as well, do you think?
I think so. But I think it's probably a better strategy for us to frame the Republican candidates as pro-Trump. I think that that's more likely what will make sense. And then for our candidates to continue to focus on, you know, issues of affordability and things that make sense. I mean, don't forget the president recently said that the affordability stuff is a hoax, a Democratic invented hoax. You know, he's getting a lot of attention for a lot of really wild things that he's saying, and I don't think it's going to get better. So, so I think the Democrats do have a chance here, sure.
But again, as I stated previously, Arizona has a long history of midterm elections that the Republicans do better than the Democrat Party. So if Tony's prediction is going to, you know, become true, then it's all going to have to be a very, very good ground game and get those voters out. Because I can tell you, we do a lot of polling at our firm, as you know.
Yeah.
I can tell you, Republicans turn out and conservative, non-affiliated voters turn out time and time again.
Do any of the – Doug, do you think any of the Democrats at the top of the ticket, Katie Hobbs, Adrian Fontes, Chris Mayes, do they have enough coattails, do you think, to bring Democrats down ballot over the finish line?
Well, it depends. You know, in Arizona, we have very few competitive legislative districts. We have 30 legislative districts, and roughly 4 to 5 are considered truly competitive.
Right.
So, I mean, we have some marquee Democrats that have just decided they're not going to run in LD9, which is in West Mesa. That's a swing district. So that right there, you know, puts them behind the eight ball. But then you have Aaron Lieberman, who a longtime state senator from the Paradise
State
Valley.
State representative,
yeah, who ran for governor. He's back, and he's going to challenge Senator Werner in LD4. So, you know, I think that there are some quality – it's all, you know, candidate quality counts. It really does. Mm-hmm. So, but I got to tell you, it's going to be an uphill battle, even with this outside money coming in. In this off cycle, even with Donald Trump's unpopularity with a broad swath of the electorate.
Tony, very quickly before we move on, do you think there's one chamber where Democrats have a better chance to flip than the other, or do you think it's sort of an equal opportunity here?
I can't say that in a way that's educated because I don't know the candidates that are recruited because I think I don't like making an assessment just based on like the math of the districts because I do think that candidate quality is wildly underestimated in a lot of this the sort of punditry that happens around this.
Fair enough. Okay, so guys, there is a proposal. Tis the season for pre-filing bills at the legislature. There's a proposal for folks who get into the legislature to give them more money, but there would be a requirement that a more stringent term limit requirement where you get 8 years in the House, 8 years in the Senate, and then you're done, as opposed to right now where you can basically just go back and forth for as long as you want to, assuming you continue to win elections. Doug, salaries haven't been raised since the late 90s. Lawmakers make $24,000 a year. It's supposed to be a part-time job. This would raise it pretty significantly, and the argument is more money, more quality candidates.
Well, there are a number of proposals out there. I'll be right up front. I'm a big supporter of raising their salaries. It was at $15,000 a year forever, and then in 1998, when Governor Jane Hull was the governor, was raised to the current $24,000 a year. Plus, they get a per diem, and if you live outside of Maricopa County, you get a lot more in per diem. But anyway, it just hasn't been raised. And I don't know anybody's salary that is working today that has not been raised since 1998. And that's a real impediment for, again, quality candidates, okay? Because you really have to be independently wealthy or retired to afford to do this. If you're a young person with a family, there's no way that you can be a legislator. And that's why we see these folks that, as I just mentioned earlier in LD9, backing away because they really cannot afford to raise their family in the salary. So something needs to be done. I am never – we do have term limits right now, and it's called an election. I'm not one for these artificial numbers, pick a number and you're done. That's not democracy in my mind. I think that the voters are discerning and they put them out. But the proposal you talked about, which is by my representative, Stacey Travers from LD12, raised it only to $35,000 a year. And then had the 16 years. If you're going to do this, go a little bit bigger and then index it. So we're not in this problem.
Index to inflation.
Yes, exactly.
Tony, do you think the salary is a reason why maybe we're not getting the caliber of candidates that we could be getting?
100%. The number of people I know who would be excellent in government that aren't able to run because they financially can't afford it is very, very high. And not only, remember, it's very expensive to run your campaign. And you can't really have a job if you're running like an effective campaign. Like, it's not really an after work type of thing for most of these races. But, the idea is the state legislature is supposed to be like a part-time job. But
the
we
citizen
know
legislature.
That it isn't. We know that it isn't. And there's huge chunks of time where these folks just have to be down there. I also think that it opens up with these low salaries. It opens us up to more pressure when it comes to sort of corruption, when it comes to people taking benefits from outside forces to for dinners and for trips and in some cases probably for money and so raising these salaries I think is in the public's best interest, but the public isn't super happy with elected officials, and so it's really challenging to get this through.
And under the Constitution, the salaries have to be voter approved.
And they've been defeated pretty much every time they've been on the ballot since then. So very quickly, do both of you think – we have about 45 seconds left. Do you both think that it is possible to craft a campaign to get voters to say yes to one of these proposals?
Yeah, well-funded with a lot of education underneath it, yes.
Yeah, I mean the city of Tucson struggled with this, but they recently passed it. Obviously, it's a different demographic, but there are some there's some campaigns you can point to see how to get this done.
All right, we'll see if that happens. Tony Connie, Doug Cole, thanks you both for coming in. Happy holidays.
Happy
really
holidays
it.
To you, Mark.
Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, the well-established debate over live versus plastic Christmas trees, plus the joy of cutting down your own.
But first, during Donald Trump's first term, actor Alec Baldwin's impression of him on Saturday Night Live was a persistent thorn in the president's side. Baldwin's performance goaded Trump into tantrums on the platform then known as Twitter. For Trump's detractors, it helped undercut the aura of invincibility that Trump sought to cultivate. Part of the impression's effectiveness had to do with the media environment of the late 2010s. When it came to political satire, SNL was arguably still the most prominent outlet for comedians to reach audiences. In the years since then, however, a little app called TikTok came along, and in 2025, a good Trump impression is a great way to build a massive following. While SNL is still goofing on the president most weekends, there's a good chance more people are getting their fix from one of the many TikTokers who've perfected Trump's distinct blend of bombast and non sequiturs. Few online comedians have done this more successfully than Matt Friend. Though Trump isn't the only character Friend does, the uncanny accuracy of his impression has been his ticket to a wide range of television appearances and a career touring comedy clubs around the country. He's coming to the Tempe Improv this weekend. I was curious to find out how he thinks about the stakes of doing this kind of comedy. What can a good impression of the president accomplish? And how much of that is intentional? I asked Friend about all of this and more earlier this week.
Trump is a personality. In that I use him to say things that I can't say as myself. Like when I'm in a show, I do crowd work as Trump.
to get away with. Like, for example, NPR is a terrible organization. The fake news, nobody likes them. They're terrible. They're disgusting. You should be ashamed of your question. You should be fired. Get him out of here. You're a pig.
Mr.
Quiet,
President.
Biggie.
Mr. President.
Quiet, Biggie.
I've been meaning to ask you about that CPB funding, by the way.
Well, that's just shut your mouth and stop talking. You see, like, these are things he actually says.
Well, that's very interesting to me, Matt. I want to ask you more about that. Like, what's interesting to you as a comedian, as a comic, about using the president's persona or your version of the president's persona to make jokes that you, as Matt Friend, wouldn't be able to make? What's interesting to you about that creatively?
It's not really interesting. It's just plain funny. It's like something is funny, yes or no, black or white. In my opinion, like Trump, like if you took away his powers and him not being the president, it's objectively hilarious. Quiet, Piggy. Like, that's insane. It's literally insane.
Right.
Because it just feels like everybody's okay with hearing it if he says it.
Right. But
it doesn't make sense. It's bizarre.
Right, right. But that's my question, I guess, is do you intend that as some sort of societal comment in any way? Because, I mean, you're making a very good point there. Like, he gets away with saying things that if almost anybody else in the world said them, we would be horrified. And when he does
you can interpret it as a comment if you wish. I am not necessarily offering a commentary. I think there's enough comedians out there that are very self-righteous and think they know what they're talking about. And I think that there's a lot of people out there that think they know what they're talking about. There's a lot of everybody's trying to add their monologue and their perspective to the discourse. I just want to make people laugh and have a great time. And all I'm doing is, in the case of this Trump impression, is I am not necessarily commenting. I'm just like, through the vehicle. Maybe I am commenting in that you can only hear it's crazy when you see someone else saying it as him.
Huh.
Like, if you can separate him, but then you see me saying it, and you see this 27-year-old, like, good-looking guy, right? See, I say it as him. You see this 27-year-old, tall, skinny guy saying it.
Yeah.
It seems somehow different than him.
Right. Well, I mean, that
is a very good question, though.
That is a fairly interesting comment, I have to say. I mean, and quite provocative, actually, if you think about it, this idea that when the actual president says the things the actual president says, we kind of treat it as like another day that ends in Y in 2025.
But exactly. No, it's true.
But when you do it, it's like, wait, that guy's the president?
It's crazy.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you think of the impression of Trump as making fun of him?
For sure.
Okay.
I mean, there's no question that it's making fun of him. But I'm not necessarily like being so pointed in my commentary. In some ways, it is a mirror to the things that these people are saying and doing.
Right.
But what's interesting about my show is, again, like, we are in very partisan times. And I personally don't see a point in taking such a partisan stance comedically in a show. I think there's enough of it. I know you could say it's idealistic and it's a different time than when Johnny Carson was on the air, but there is something to be said of, like, let's just all go into this comedy club and all, like, laugh at everything going on.
Well, in the vein of all this, can I ask you, I mean, you did the Trump impression multiple times on Fox and Friends, which is a show that it is widely acknowledged that the president himself watches.
Yep. And I was at Stephen Colbert yesterday doing it.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, yeah. We know he watches that,
well,
too.
I have quite the range.
Yeah. But is that something you thought about when you went to Fox and Friends? Were you thinking, like, he's going to see this?
I think he's watching all of it. What's crazy about that is that I have not had the experience of having an actual effect or impact after I go on a TV show, and I've done a lot of shows, other than that show, in terms of, like, people buying tickets to come to my shows and hearing from them how great or whatever they thought I was. But to answer your question, I assumed he'd be watching it. I have no idea what he thinks, because I'm basically lampooning him and everything.
Well, that's so, my question. That's my question, Matt, is, I mean, as I know you must know, it is practically verboten to go on Fox News programming and speak negatively about the president or make fun of the president. And just to quote one of your own jokes to you, I'm not going to do it as well as you did, of course, but you said something like, Trump destroyed the East Wing of the White House. He must have gotten it confused with the Epstein files. I mean, that's a pretty cutting joke. And people laughed. What do you think it is about you doing the impression in that environment that, I don't know, makes them okay with it in a way that they generally aren't?
You know, it's a great question. I do not know. And I think it's very interesting that they're able to laugh at themselves. And you got to give them credit.
But I guess I'm curious. I mean, and not to harp on this too much, but it is fascinating to me, Matt, that you're saying, you know, like, I'm just a comedian, I'm just a comic, I'm just here to make people laugh, whoever they may be. But I can't help noticing that a significant number of the impressions you do, and they're on both sides of the aisle, are politicians, very famous politicians who are, some of them are loved, generally speaking, and some of them are loathed, generally speaking. So that's an interesting tension to me, I guess, that as someone who is taking this notionally sort of apolitical stance, you are real, you do lean into politics quite a bit.
Love it. I love it. I mean, it's no secret. Like, I grew up in Chicago, you know, liberal upbringing. But I just think, like, now it's like, if you can find a way to get to, like, to get as many people as possible having a good time, I don't see an issue with that. But at the same time, like, there's nothing to me that is funnier than the political world. I mean, it's just so absurd. I think it's just the most important thing in comedy, to answer this question, is, are they laughing really hard or are they not? And that is the metric that I care about. But let people, you know, just judge for themselves and just have a good time. I mean, if you're interested in seeing Mitch McConnell getting down and dirty, well, I would say you're going to have a good time. And then you get over here and you get Barack Obama. He's having a great time on NPR. And let me just say this. Okay, this is Howard. It's not all politics. This is Howard Stern. NPR is fantastic. John Oliver, what is going on? Okay, this is Bill Maher. New rule. Why are we even doing this? I don't even know, right? So to answer your question, I just completely deflected and it became 10 other people. So enjoy the show.
That was a very show don't tell answer, I have to say. Well, I have been speaking with Matt Friend, who is a comedian and a gifted, as you just heard, impressionist. He will be at the Tempe Improv this weekend on December 12th and 13th. Matt, thank you for this conversation.
Yes, yeah. Thank you for having me. Such a nice conversation. Appreciate it.
With the recent anniversary of the bombing of Pearl Harbor, KJZZ reporter Gabriel Pietrazio has been documenting the historical context of the U.S. response to the attack. In a week-long series, he looks at Arizona's connection to the Japanese internment policies that were instituted following Pearl Harbor and how it ties into the broader story of racialized public policy. Gabe joins me now for a closer look at his series. Gabe, good morning.
Morning, Sam.
So, Gabe, listeners may be generally aware with the Japanese internment camps, but not necessarily aware of Arizona's role in this particular chapter of history. Tell us about the state's role in the story.
Yeah, for sure. So briefly, two of the 10 main internment camps that were run by the U.S. War Relocation Authority were in Arizona, would have equated at that time to the third and fourth largest cities behind only Phoenix and Tucson. And those two sites were both on tribal reservations here.
Yes, and that's a very critical part of the reporting that you've done here. Why did the U.S. decide to put the Arizona camps on tribal land? Because they didn't do that in other states, right?
That's right. These are the outliers of the 10. And what we kind of unearthed was essentially this idea that derives from a stereotype that Japanese Americans were seen as industrious and apt with agriculture and other sorts of projects that they could do to essentially develop these lands for the benefit of the indigenous communities there without their consent. The tribes obviously opposed the idea of having people interred there, and the Office of Indian Affairs, which is now the Bureau of Indian Affairs, was essentially behind that push in partnership with the U.S. War Relocation Authority to bring the camps here.
Well, and the timing of all this in the history of the tribes in Arizona is very significant, right? Because many of them were just getting organized into a formalized council at the time. And it seems from your reporting like the government used that as leverage to some extent.
Certainly. We spoke with the chairwoman from the Colorado River Indian Tribes, Amelia Flores, and she explained to me that she felt that they were being taken advantage of. The tribes, Gila River Indian Community and the Colorado River Indian Tribes, or CRIT, both only had no more than 6 years as formalized governments with their constitutions ratified in the eyes of the U.S. before these camps were essentially thrust onto their lands without much legal recourse. And so tribes at that time, fledgling new nations in the eyes of the U.S. and when it comes to federal Indian policy, as we understand it to be, were essentially at the whims of the agency, despite this push from being wards to sovereigns of their lands.
Well, and of course, speaking of tribes being forced to do things without consent, as one historian that you spoke to put it, part of the precedent for this Japanese internment policy was the Indian Removal Act of 1830.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I think we see similar trends and echoes of the history of forced relocation, resettlement. So in the case of Japanese Americans, they were what the U.S. called excluded essentially from the West Coast and forced inland to the east, whereas more than a century prior under the Indian Removal Act of 1830 with President Andrew Jackson, we saw tribes being pushed from the East Coast to the West. So mirroring kind of policies at different times in our nation's history, both under the influence of the U.S. military as a force to enact that policy.
So as part of your reporting on this, Gabe, you went to an annual ceremony that commemorates the lives of people who died in one of these camps here in Arizona. Describe that scene for us. This was the camp in Poston, correct?
That's right. It was Poston Camp, and that's the one located at the Colorado River Indian Tribes, CRIT, Parker. And they've been doing this annual pilgrimage for at least 7 years, close to a decade at this point. But survivors came back with their families as well as other descendants to honor, essentially, by naming each of the 290, upwards of 300 or so reported deaths that were inside that facility. At its peak population, it was nearly 18,000 and would have been the third largest behind Phoenix and Tucson population-wise. But it was a very powerful experience that kind of set the tone. And there were songs, bird songs and dances from youth members of the tribe before we all set out on the pilgrimage to the actual site of the former camps.
Now, there's a fascinating contrast here. Because as part of your reporting, you also visited the site of the other camp, which was originally known as the Rivers Relocation Center. And that's not easy to do, visiting that camp. They don't have a similar tradition there.
It's different. And what is difficult is you have to go through a process to obtain a permit. It took a few months. The Gila River Indian Community granted that to me and to see this space. They reiterate, these aren't tours. This is a site where people were held against their will. Another 200 or so died there at their peak population, approaching 14,000 internees, and was the fourth largest would have been city at the time. And so they have a more, reflective experience for people.
Yeah.
Because they want to protect that space from outsiders and trespassers, essentially. And so they do annual site cleanups there with partnership through the Japanese American Citizens League of Arizona chapter, but also invite descendants to return.
Well, I have been speaking with KJZZ's tribal natural resources reporter, Gabriel Piatarazio, about his, again, multi-part, really expansive series on all this that contains so much more than what we've been able to touch on today. But Gabe, thank you for your reporting and thank you for this conversation.
Thanks for having me.
Good morning. This is The Show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. And despite the temperatures, we promise the holiday season really is upon us. Hanukkah begins on Sunday evening, and this weekend, lots of families will be hunting for Christmas trees. So today we wanted to share our co-host Lauren Gilger's wonderful segment from 2022 about finding her own tree.
I am big on holiday traditions, from cookies to carols to gumbo on Christmas Eve. And last year, my family and I started a new one, heading up north for a day to cut down our own Christmas tree. It sounded magical. In our first year, it was. We drove up northeast of Camp Verde into the Tonto National Forest and found snow. Picturesque pines covered in fresh snow. And though we froze, we found a pretty, if not exactly traditional-looking, Christmas tree. I loved it. But this year, when we ventured up to the forest, instead of snow, we found rain.
It's real rain. It's wet.
Are you going to get all wet now?
And it's chilly.
Yeah. Are you ready for Christmas trees?
Yes.
Zeebo, you ready for Christmas trees?
Yeah.
But even so, with my two little boys, parents, and husband in tow, we piled on our coats and hats and grabbed an umbrella and headed out into the woods somewhere near Strawberry on a day that ended up being one of the wettest this winter. And while I had visions of tall pines with elegant branches dancing in my head, that's not exactly what we found. You see them over here?
It's really raining, dudes.
It's really raining.
Here, look at this little one.
That's a good little one. That's very little. These look pretty good. What do you think about these? No?
Those are not pines.
You're right, they're cedar. So we drove to another spot not too far away, and then another. All right, that one didn't work. Next stop, where are we going?
Going up past Strawberry, because we already missed the other one because it was only cedars.
Only cedars. But after a few hours of this, we were soaked, muddy, cold, and the kids had eaten me out of snacks. So at the last spot we looked, I found our tree. It is tiny, as Christmas trees go, not much taller than my five-year-old, with long, needly branches and a sincerely Charlie Brown feel. But he loves it. And we were all ready to warm up.
All right, we found a tree, Nat.
Yep.
Are you freezing?
No.
Are you wet?
Yes.
Are you happy?
Yes, yes.
It's a little tree, but we got a good one.
Yeah, it's mine.
It's for you.
And we'll get a bigger one at Home Depot.
Yeah, we're going to have to get the bigger one at Home Depot.
We did get a bigger tree at Home Depot, but the kids are pretty pleased with their special little tree that they cut down in the forest. And maybe next year we'll go straight to Home Depot. But if you're not quite as adventurous or unprepared as me, what should you do? Go for a real tree at a lot or invest in a fake one that will last a long time? Well, our next guest is with environmental charity One Tree Planted. So he looks at this age-old debate from an environmental point of view, and his take is a little counterintuitive.
You know, at One Tree Planted, we plant trees, so why would we possibly be encouraging cutting down a tree?
Ross Burnett is a forestry specialist with One Tree Planted and says it's a complicated calculation and probably differs by region.
In general, we actually think it's more beneficial to use a real tree. Hmm. This is a natural thing that can biodegrade depending on how you kind of deal with it, where you get it, and then what you do with it after can actually be much more sustainable than the plastic involved in an artificial tree.
That's so interesting because it does sort of seem counterintuitive, right? Like you're planting trees, going down and cutting down one doesn't seem like a great idea. Talk about the carbon footprints that go into each of these because I understand you have pretty precise calculations for why this is the case.
So yeah, we looked at some statistics actually generated from a group called the Carbon Trust that really did a life cycle analysis. And with oftentimes the artificial trees coming from overseas, you know, a lot of shipping involved, plastic, metal, all these things that are involved in producing that tree, you know, the statistics come up to about 88 pounds of carbon dioxide per tree,
wow,
which can actually be over 10 times higher than the amount grown if it's a sustainably grown, recycled Christmas tree of a real, you know, a real pine.
What if you kind of hold on to a fake tree for a long time and use it for years on end? Like a lot of people will say it's got to be more sustainable because you don't have to get a new one every year.
It is a really good point. And that's why it gets complicated, right? But if you are holding on to a Christmas tree, a fake tree for more than 10 years, it can start to balance out. But that's kind of the timeline involved. So if you really think there's a good chance you're going to hold on to that tree for 10 years, it may come out similar in terms of a carbon dioxide, carbon footprint perspective. But we're still talking about plastics and metals that are just basically impossible to be recycled. So, you know, it's hard to actually compare apples to oranges.
Interesting. So then there's got to be some complications in terms of where you can cut down a Christmas tree to be sustainably helpful. My family, of course, went up to the National Forest, got one of the permits this year. We tried to cut one down, didn't find a very pretty one, but, you know, we did our best. Where can you cut down these trees to have this kind of lower environmental impact?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'm super glad to hear you guys like did all the right permitting and things. We don't want to encourage people just going out to random forests and chopping down trees.
You can't
that's for
do that,
sure.
Yes.
But there are ways to do it more sustainably. So, yep, for one, getting the right permit. And this is going to be something that's so dependent on where you are, right? Every state is going to have kind of different policies. But there are a lot of really focused tree farms, Christmas tree farms around the country that do provide this ability for people to go and cut down their own tree. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times these are groups that are, you know, doing it for the right reasons. They want people to understand where are these trees coming from. Because even if you're growing a tree, right, it can still provide habitat for animals and a lot of benefits to the environment while it's growing. And then there is such a thing as sustainable forestry management. Mm-hmm. So these are like forests that can be, you know, you take down a few trees per year in certain areas and you just like, you know, trees naturally die and come in a forest. So yeah, it's sort of a cycle and it can be done really well.
I thought of this when we were doing this, like there's a, if you're getting the permit from, you know, as we did the Tonto National Forest here, like they're trying to thin these forests in a lot of areas anyway. Is that why they give out Christmas tree permits every year?
You know, that's a great question. So I live in Berkeley, California, and, you know, a lot of the West does suffer from actually too many trees overstocking. We've suppressed forest fire for like a century. And so, you know, thinning is what the kind of forestry term is called. Thinning a forest can actually improve forest health.
Right.
So I think probably you're going to have different forestry management issues, whether you're in the Northeast, Southeast, around the country, it's going to be kind of different. So yeah, it's an opportunity to learn about your local forest.
Okay, so lastly, then we have to talk about what you do with the tree after Christmas, of course, because this has to be an important part of actually making the more environmentally sustainable choice here. How do you recycle a Christmas tree? Why is that important?
We call it the life cycle analysis. So like, where did it come from? And then what happens when you're done with it? And so it's important to consider all those factors. So a lot of cities have tree recycling programs. And the best case scenario is they're like turning that into mulch, which is going to like, you know, mulch a local park or give away to homeowners. And that is the best approach because you're then like part of the cycle of creating soil. So that's awesome. Hmm. If you have a wood chipper, you know, you do that yourself. You could donate it to local environmental organizations. They can repurpose it. You know, I've even read of protecting riparian areas or protecting fragile sand dunes, creating wildlife shelter, etc. So yeah, I mean, if you bury it in a landfill, that's probably a pretty bad thing to do because that could turn into methane.
Right.
So you really want to think through and find out like what is the easiest way, but also the least bad. Do a little research in your area and find out what opportunities there are to think through what happens next. You don't just want to like put that on the curb necessarily and have that go into a landfill.
Yeah. All right. That is Ross Burnett, a forestry specialist at One Tree Planted, joining us to talk more about the great debate between real versus fake trees. Ross, thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate it very much.
So awesome talking to you. Thanks for having me.
And that'll do it for this Friday edition of the show. The show was produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayanna Hamilton, as well as Bruce Drummond. Sky Shout is our digital editor. Claire Lawton is our newsletter editor. Chad Snow is the news director. The show was created by John Hoban. Our executive producer is Amy Silverman. And speaking of that newsletter, you can sign up for it. It is called Radioheads. You can sign up at theshow.kjzz.org. While you're online, you might as well just go to social media. Follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ, the show. For Sam Dingman and Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Have a great weekend. Hope to have you right back here on Monday.